I'm Kevin Middleton.
And I'm Samantha Berg. And this is The Bridge to Everywhere. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere. Join us as we explore health, community, and culture from a holistic perspective. Health topics addressed on our show are for information and entertainment and should not be taken as medical advice. If you have a medical condition, please consult an appropriate care provider.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere. I'm Kevin Middleton, and I'm here in the studio with Samantha Berg. And today we are interviewing Elisa Elliott-Rector, and she's a pediatric occupational therapist over at her clinic, which is Mountain Magic Therapy for Kids in Palmer. Now, we're going to be talking a lot about raising happy, grounded children. And this is such an important topic, and we're really, really happy to have Elisa here with us today. And before we get into that program, I just want to wish everyone a wonderful Christmas Eve, and I hope you're enjoying time with your family and friends, and thanks for taking a little time to listen in with us tonight.
Okay, so I'd like to introduce Elisa to our audience. And Elisa Elliott-Rector, OTRL, is a pediatric occupational therapist who's been working with children of all ages and skill levels to help them be comfortable and present in their bodies, their relationships, and their environment. Helping parents help their kids is her priority with her treatment, but she also uses sensory integration treatment, cranial sacral therapy, hands-on muscle input, yoga, feeding treatment, therapeutic listening, and play-based interventions in her clinic, Mountain Magic Therapy for Kids in Palmer. And Elisa says she loves her job.
So, and that really shows.
And that does show. So welcome. We're really happy to have you on the program.
Thank you.
So we'd like to get a little bit of a sense of your background.
Okay.
So tell us how you got interested in becoming an occupational therapist. Now, clearly from that bio I just read, you're not doing the traditional occupational therapist route. You're doing some different things than OTs would be doing?
No, actually, you know, occupational therapists have a very, very broad range of practice, and pediatric, even within the pediatric field, some of us go into hand therapy, some of us go into ergonomics, some of us, you know, work for school districts working on handwriting. I chose to go into private practice so I could do the wide variety that I like to do with children.
So how does one become an OT? What's the process?
Well, it's just like any other sort of mainstream profession. You apply to a program and you get accepted. Right now, it's the bare minimum is a master's level certification. There's others who are pursuing the doctorate level for occupational therapists, and that's a pretty new development in our field.
Does it require a full four-year degree before going into a program?
Yes. I was fortunate. I consider myself fortunate enough to have gotten my degree when it was just a bachelor's. At the time, the only difference between my training and the master's level was they had to do a research project that we didn't have to do. And so I, from then on, was able to take continuing education courses to sort of fine-tune the way I did my practice.
And what's it? We've had some physical therapists on the program. So just for the sake of our audience who may not know the difference, I know a lot of people don't really understand the distinction between what is an occupational therapist versus what's a physical therapist, and why would you choose to go to one over the other. So could you say a little bit of? I know it's a huge topic, but
yeah,
but
I'll try to make it as small as possible. And there's a lot of jokes that go between OTs and PTs and speech therapists actually, mm-hmm. because OTs tend to play all fields. There's some of what we do that really helps kind of the goals of physical therapy. Our profession is defined our foundation is working with vets coming home from the wars and after World War I and helping them get back into the activities that they valued, that made them feel important, that helped them feel grounded. And back then, occupation meant anything that you did, not just a job. And so essentially what we do is strive to help people do the things they want to do in life. So it's pretty vague. Everybody, you know, we've all done something different with that definition of our profession. Whereas physical therapists tend to be more mobility oriented and more, you know, very specific physical complaints. OTs also work with very specific physical complaints. We do not work with mobility. that's kind of the big one of the big things. But we there's a lot of us that work with pain issues. Some of us, like I said, we're hand therapists. So there's a lot more flexibility with how we define our profession than I believe physical therapists do.
The distinction I see usually, I think about if somebody's recovering from an injury or from surgery and they're just trying to get their mobility back or their range of motion, or some cases preventative, like I see a physical therapist for prevention too,
to keep
myself from getting out of balance. And I see the occupational therapist more like you said, trying to get back to do the things that you were doing in your life before, but for some reason you're not able to do. You need help to sort out how to do that. And that could be anything from feeding yourself to driving a car to getting in and out of your car after you've had an injury, those kinds of things.
And I wonder, and so in some ways it could have a lot more specificity in the specific motions.
Yes.
Like somebody's maybe had an automobile injury and there's something, you know, about just even moving their legs to get them up into a car and then to drive.
And that's, there's that piece, but there's also, you know, we focus on more kind of the fine-tuned type things, like if you're not able to brush your teeth anymore, or, you know, getting in and out of the car can actually go either OT or PT. But turning the ignition on might be more us than PT. it's hard to define it really.
But you're working mostly
functional activities are our ultimate goal. Mm-hmm. And we actually, there's even a lot of OTs that work in psychiatric wards. So it's not limited to physical issues, but cognitive and mental issues as well, emotional issues.
And how did you decide to work with children specifically?
Well, when I was going through school, we got to our children's unit and our unit on sensory integration came up. And I was completely blown away and moved by it. I have a soft spot for children that are misunderstood by adults. And so sensory integration, for me, organized a lot of those misconceptions that adults have about children and defined them in a way that really made sense to me.
Could you give us an example of some of those misconceptions?
Well, like for me, for instance, and this is probably why it touched my heart so much. As I was going through school, you know, I'm a smart person, but I was not physically stimulated enough to attend to what my teacher was saying. So I would get up and sharpen my pencil over and over again. I would go to the bathroom. I would do everything I could to move and help myself get alert so that I could actually pay attention to what was going on. And sensory integration helps explain that you need to stimulate your senses in order to be alert and focused. And for me, alertness was an issue. And so I provided myself my own form of stimulation, which was all these extra movements. I probably wiggled in my seat a lot. I definitely chewed on my pencils, rubbed my eyes, my hair, played with my hair. I mean, I was a fidgeter for sure.
Right. And so from the teacher's perspective, you might have been considered disruptive, and yet you were actually trying to pay attention.
I was trying really hard to pay attention.
You were doing your best to be awake and be attentive in class.
Yes.
But from a teacher's perspective, who I'm sure at the time maybe had 20-something kids as opposed to now where they have 30-something kids, but it's still, you know, if you have one kid doing that, he might perceive it as distracting the other kids, right?
Yes. And so it just made a lot of sense. And since then, it's actually helped me focus better as an adult, like just that knowledge base. And so it just ignited a fire in me. I really wanted to help all these kids that were getting diagnosed with ADHD or all these kids that are, you know, autistic that are having a hard time self-regulating. What can I say? I mean, from then on, there's no intellectual answer. It was a fire that burned inside me that I really,
really connected with.
Yeah.
So along those lines, one of the things we talked about before the show was just the fact that we're seeing more and more kids that are having these kinds of troubles. I mean, I can't remember growing up and hearing even about ADHD or ADD as it used to be called before. And so now it just seems rampant. It just seems like, there, you know, we have so many, I mean, I guess when I was growing up, we maybe had one special education teacher in the entire school. And now I see, you know, the school right. district has, yeah. you know, I mean, I don't know, it seems
teams
like...
teams of special yeah, education
exactly.
professionals.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a,
yes.
it's a huge issue. So what is going on? Like, why are kids having
And as you answer
time?
That, maybe bring in what sensory integration means and what that is.
Okay. All right. So I guess my best perception of this is that I had spent some time in Zimbabwe and visited a village, and I was really, really impressed with the children there. It seemed like the village kids were much more calm. They weren't picky eaters. They listened to their parents. And, I mean, not to say that country doesn't have big problems, but the children seemed really regulated to me, much more than I see in this country.
And so, let me back up just for, what do you mean by regulated? Just like able to self-soothe?
Self-soothe, pay attention.
Mm-hmm. Less emotional volatility.
Exactly. Yeah, there was just, they were just steady. You know, steady and calm. You know, their parents talked to them like they were little adults. There was nothing, you know, they didn't have to do those special tricks that we have to as parents in our culture. And so, to me, I mean, we're wired for that setting, for quiet, you know, for not a lot of extraneous stimulation. You know, we're wired for walking many, you know, a couple hours a day, walking outside in nature. With skin, you know, with the wind, you know, the stimulation being the wind and the sunshine and the birds flying over you. And that is how I believe we are wired. And, you know, fundamentally, now, you know, granted there are, you know, huge branches of culture that grew up in cities and, you know, had more stimulation than that. But again, you walked to where you were going. There's, you know, well, I guess I'm going to have to explain what sensory integration is at this point because it doesn't make sense until I really say it. Sensory integration is the process in which we take in information from our senses and integrate it into a complete picture and respond to it. It's something that appears to happen instantaneously. Like it's not breaking down into steps with our perceptions. I mean, but there is. They're all very separate processes that happen instantaneously. And this includes information that's going on within our body. So whether, you know, we're not digesting well, I mean, our brain is processing all of this information and we're responding to it and interacting with our world.
So this is all the stuff coming in from our visual sense, from our ears, the smells, the sounds, plus yeah. whatever's happening inside our body.
Well, and it's much more than that. The three senses that I actually focus on the most in treatment are our vestibular sense, which, you know, I'm going to use some big words here, but the vestibular is essentially what is gravity doing to us at any moment. And proprioception is where our body is in space. So, and we get that information through our joints. And the last one is our sense of touch, which, you know, we're all pretty well aware of. But so those three senses are actually the fundamental foundation for how we develop our other senses. It affects our vision. It affects how we perceive smells. And our auditory processing as well. The way we process sound is very closely linked to how we perceive gravity, and so they're both in the ear, and they're both like in the right in the middle of your central nervous system. Like, so
that's fascinating. So, you know, really, this is all just to help us place ourselves in three-dimensional time and space.
Exactly. And so, when I talk about the activities that we engaged in, you know, say a couple thousand years ago, you know, that's what I'm talking about. I mean, when you walk to where you need to go, you're stimulating your vestibular system, your sense of balance, and it's, you know, giving you a sense of right and left. It's helping you integrate the, you know, the both sides of your body. It's It's telling you whether you're going up or down. I mean, it's, and if you don't have that information, it totally dysregulates you. But they've done studies on rats that that gave birth in space, and they brought the babies back down to Earth. They're aggressive. They were very emotional.
Not integrated mice.
They were not integrated at all. They were not grounded.
It sounds a little familiar there, doesn't it? And
yeah.
I think about the kids that we, you know, like from the moment they're born, they're put in a car seat and they're put, you know, driven around all over the place in a car.
Well, and then they don't even get taken out when they go to restaurants or grocery stores, you know. And traditional cultures carried their babies everywhere. So from the minute you were born, you understood right and left, of the right and left balance of walking, of bending, you know, your mother bending over and standing up, or, you know, if you're from a culture where they hung you in a tree, you know, hung you in a bassinet in the tree, you know, you're getting the motions of the tree. I mean, you've got a lot more motion when, you know, back in the day than we do now. The motion we get now is very linear. Hmm. You know, you're in a car, you're in a car seat, you're in a jumper, you know, like that hangs in the doorway. I mean, it's all up and down or, you know, forward, backward. And we are three-dimensional people. You know, we need that rotation. We need the up and, you know, bending over and standing up. And it really sets a much stronger framework for how you organize the rest of your senses. And so yeah, I mean, just the sense of the way our senses are getting stimulated is so different now. And, you know, with our vestibular system, I mean, if you even like it's the oldest sense in our body. Even an amoeba has a vestibular system. It's the most primitive. It's the most central. And so we have altered that so much, and everything else about how we perceive our world builds upon that, you know, among other things. Mm-hmm. But and it's closely tied in with emotional regulation, because if you don't have a strong sense of where your body position is in space, it produces anxiety.
Mm-hmm. So insecurity.
You
don't know where you are.
Yeah, you don't know where you are.
And not even have a way of articulating or explaining it. It might just be a disruptive sense.
Exactly. I mean, even as adults, it could be just a disruptive sense. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't have a way to, you know, to point it out, you know, when people, you know, get claustrophobia. It's like, you know, I don't know what it is about those small spaces, but.
Well, it's an interesting thing, because I know one of the things I've heard is that as a, that we experience more sensory stimulation in, you know, one day than the average cave person would have experienced 30,000 years ago in their entire lifetime.
Yeah,
so there's
exactly.
That piece. And then there's also all the ways we're overstimulating our nervous system with video games and cartoons and sugar and wheat. So there's like food things, and then there's food additives, and then there's visual stuff. But again, all of that is an issue, but you're talking about something that's underneath all of that. Like if you had a nervous system that if there was a sense of security, then all these other things wouldn't affect the person, but they
maybe
might be able to
do it better. Maybe there's a ground underneath
their feet. Exactly. Yeah, that's it. And I'm just talking about, you know, when I talk about why we're seeing dysregulated kids, I'm just going to talk it just from the sensory perspective. I mean, that's not even going into the whole food thing, the types of the medicines and chemicals we're exposed to now, technology.
Cell phone radiation.
Wi-Fi. know, the light pulses from a screen. Mm-hmm. I mean, that goes directly into our brain. I mean, there's so many things we don't understand about that.
Right. But they're all of this is what you're talking about is just something that's underneath all of that.
Exactly.
And so if we can get to that place, you know, then maybe we can start to pull apart out of the other things what's actually causing the major problem. But until you can get this one piece regulated, it sounds like, you know, you can eliminate all the other stuff, but the person at the core is still going to have some sense of anxiety or emotional volatility.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So what do we do next? So a typical kid who, let's kind of get a sense of a typical kid who might come in your office. I know typical is kind of a funny word, but just some case presentation that you would think would sort of, what you would expect to see with a kid who was, you know, dysregulated.
Yeah.
And then maybe walk through the different senses and how you'd work
I work with I work with such a wide variety of kids. There's kids that have very, you know, definable diagnoses. And then there's some that just are having a hard time with life. And so I am talking about what might seem like a typical kid who's having a hard time in school, having a hard time with relationships, having a, you know, hard time sitting still. You know, that's, and that's a very broad thing, because some kids are, you know, some kids kind of fall into the overreactive category, and some kids fall into the underreactive category. And those are the kids that kind of just, you know, just shut down. Like, it's just easier to shut down and withdraw, and they kind of look more depressive as opposed to hyper.
And is there an age where, as a parent, you would be looking for this? I mean, obviously, I'm sure there's signs, all, you know, from
the
newborn,
beginning.
But is there a time where often parents start to become aware of it and bring their kid in?
I tend to see it kind of on the early end for if we're looking at just sensory integration challenges. The earliest I tend to see is about 2. Parents are much more, you know, they start looking at their, you know, comparing their children to other children at that age, and, you know, and they're, it starts occurring to them there might, that, so that's a kind of on the early side. You know, I would love to get, you know, irritable babies. Like, that would be my dream, because we can take care of so many problems if the irritable babies, you know, if I could help with the situation from the beginning.
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Like, you know, wouldn't it be great if it's, you know, then you'd be really working on more of the preventative,
you know,
care side.
You know, I'm talking, like, you know, unresolved colic, you know, I could probably be done in 6 months. You know, and a lot of kids I see for a couple of years. So, you know, 2, I would say, is probably on average at the early end.
And
other times it's 5 or 6.
And just to make sure I get this right, so some of this, these early, you know, troubles really do advance then, if they're not addressed, to some of what we're seeing down
yes.
the
road
in terms of
yes.
Disruptive behavior and lack of ease. And
yeah, because the anxiety is always there. I mean, that's kind of the discomfort, you know, might not ever go away. And so, you know, just this, you know, of not being comfortable in their body.
And then everybody's going to come up with a different way to compensate for that. So, like you said,
yes.
some people compensate for that by acting out, and others compensate by withdrawing. But it's still
yes.
it's a compensation for the same thing.
Yes, yes.
It's going to be a real challenge for parents, too, because they just obviously just want to help baby. And it's not really, is it commonly known that this would be a good avenue for intervention? Is this?
No, no.
Yeah.
I find word of mouth between parents is probably my best referral source. There's quite a few pediatricians in the community that seem to be on top of it, and so that's nice. But of course, this is after they've done medical interventions and haven't gotten anywhere.
So they've already exposed
yeah.
the child to more medical interventions or
yeah. yeah. And, you know, and they're just doing their job. You know, I'm not blaming anybody, but boy, I would love to get more,
more
early.
Okay. So you've got, somebody comes in.
Yeah, yeah. Somebody comes into my clinic, and I have some assessment. I use clinical observations, and I use parent assessment, you know, parent questionnaires, you know, standardized forms that sort of give me an overall picture. And so then, you know, looking at all the different senses, how they put them together, and what the output looks like. And so I can kind of get an idea of what, you know, what the day-to-day life of, you know, the parent and child is like. And so then and the treatment is often quite the same no matter what the output is. You know, you have to stimulate the senses, because that's usually where it starts. It sounds crazy, but the three basic senses quite often don't get stimulated enough. Vision and sound get stimulated, you know, way too much, like way before everything else is formed. And so, you know, we have kids that, you know, like I said, we're just getting limited movement as infants and children. And so like for a vestibular, you know, to treat the vestibular or sense of balance, relationship to gravity and space, I use a lot of swings. I use, talk to parents about wrestling with their kids, trampolines. I mean, I stimulating the senses, those three basic senses are the best way to strengthen them. And
so vestibular, proprioception, and tactile.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And so, yeah, like, and so with the vestibular, you know, and I just, you know, I work with the parents on trying to find ways to get a variety of stimulation, whether it's going to the park, you know, unplugging them from their screens is an important component of that, because, I mean, that's, you know, they need to move, and screens are very alluring for kids. And so just getting out and playing, running with their friends, if, you know, if they have friends, climbing, jumping, you know, wrestling with mom and dad, blanket swings, you know, wrapping them up like a hot dog and swinging them. You know, it's all fun stuff, you know, and kids love to move. But, you know, some of the children I see, you know, are afraid to move. And so, but you have to go at their pace. You know, this is not meant to be anxiety provoking. So I'll do things like lower a swing to the ground and they can just play with it. And eventually they crawl on. And once they get going, they crave it. They can't get enough.
So do you also train the parents then to continue with some of these motions and movements?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Yeah. And that's ultimately my goal. And they don't need fancy equipment. I mean, it's not. So it's more, you know, just getting a variety of moving, get the head, you know, get them bending over and standing up, and just, you know, all the varieties of ways in which we move, you know, up it, you know, just jack it up, and make it fun, because that's the only way you're going to get the kid on board.
Yeah, and maybe, I mean, I think the parents overall, the way they hold it is probably such an important part of the healing process, because if it's considered a problem and there's something really wrong, it's going to set the wrong tone. But to make it really fun, to say, oh, this is really an exciting thing and we're all doing it together, that would probably make a huge difference.
Yeah. Yeah, and like I said, I mean, this is for kids that don't move a lot or kids that move too much. Either way, it's the same treatment.
So what about things like parents taking their kids to swimming lessons when they're really, you know, as soon as they feel like they're ready for it, or even I'm thinking now, like, all those bouncy bear places where I kind of get a little freaked out because I think they're just covered.
Yeah, no, they're germ madness.
However, it seems like, I mean, they are, like, sort of bouncing around and moving all over the place from that. And, you know, it's not bad to get exposed to some germs and build up your immune system.
I'm big proponents for those places. I mean, despite the germy part, but you know,
you can take a bath,
feed your kids some vitamin C, you know, wash them up when you're done, do your best.
Well, we do have a little bit of a fear of germs in our culture, though. I mean, we really do want to get exposed to a lot of things when you're young. So. But yeah, there's something about that freaks me out. But I can see the benefit of it, though, because they're crawling around, they're falling off of those little balls, they're getting under things, they're wrestling with other kids.
And they're getting a lot of unexpected movement, which is really important. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we don't have the playgrounds. Like, I mean, the things that I used to that I think of, you know, growing up with, because a lot of them are kind of dangerous.
Yeah.
So they're, you know, and they're not necessarily, unless your parent is right there to supervise you, one of those outdoor playgrounds that we probably, you know, grew up with, where you've got the monkey bars. You know, now people are thinking you should probably put a helmet on a kid before they go on the monkey bars.
I know.
You know, I'm wondering, and part of the therapy, is there some variation for cognitive learning styles? Is that part of the, you know, the work you do?
Yeah. And I, variation as far as stimulating the basic senses.
Yeah, I mean, different children will learn.
Do you evaluate, you know, if somebody's an auditory learner or a visual learner?
I definitely look at that. And I do these activities before I do higher level activities. This is how I do my practice. We go through these three basic senses, and actually in the order I said, vestibular, proprioceptive, tactile. And because those are kind of, that's the layer. The vestibular is central, proprio is next, and then tactile is kind of the third layer to how we perceive our world. And so I actually work on those, and then I'll work on a higher level cognitive skill.
Great. So I think what we're going to do is take a short break right now, and then we'll come back and we'll talk more to occupational therapist Elisa, and we'll be right back.
Thanks for joining us. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Bridge to Everywhere. We're speaking with Alisa Elliott Rector. She is an occupational therapist specializing in pediatrics. Before we get back into the program, I just really wanted to invite everyone to, if you're not already a member of KVRF Radio Free Palmer, to go to the website, radiofreepalmer.org, and join now. And, if you want, you can also just drop by the station. We're right above Turkey Red Restaurant, and you can just slip a check under the door. It's $25 for a basic membership, and it makes this kind of content possible. This community is amazing. There's phenomenal people here. And this station just really wouldn't function without you, and we're so happy to be a part of it, and we appreciate the volunteers that make this program happen and your support.
And it's fun. Don't forget how much fun it is.
It is so fun.
It's fun to be a member. Okay, so we're back speaking with Alisa about pediatric occupational therapy, and we want to go into the two sensory systems that we didn't really get in depth yet with, and that would be proprioception and tactile.
Yes.
So we'll talk about that, and then we're going to go into a little bit of, we're going to talk maybe about some case studies, and we also wanted to get some information about working with kids with on the autism spectrum, and then we'll talk a little bit about prevention. So let's start with the two sensory pieces that we missed.
Okay, so proprioception is essentially gives parameters to our bodies, and we have sensors in each of our joints that get stimulated every time we're squeezed, every time we walk. These sensors get stimulated, and it tells our body or tells our brain where our body is in space and what the parameters are. And so this is pretty important. A lot of nervous habits come from this. Tapping your foot, stimulates your proprioception. Chewing on your fingernails stimulates your proprioception. It's something we all do, and we can't function. We do these habits, so it's a way of self-regulating, and so in treatment, I would do things like have kids jump and crash into a giant pillow. I would have them do elephant walks where they're stomping their feet. I would give them bear hugs. There's hugging is like by far the best proprioceptive activity out there, And this is a pretty important piece as well, because that, like I said, if you don't know where your body is in space, on the extreme end, you'll have a kid, a kid who might bang their head a lot when they're upset, and it's almost like they get upset and they escalate and they bang their head to bring themselves back. Sometimes it's to, let their parent know just how upset they are, but I believe it starts as a self-regulation behavior. Hand flapping, with some of our kids on the autism spectrum, there's a whole myriad of types of things you'll see when this system needs to be stimulated. And then on somebody who's more kind of on the under-responsive side, you might not see any of that, but they would still, that kind of activity would wake their nervous systems up a little bit. So,
and what about the third system?
Tactile, so our sense of touch. I get a lot of kids who come to me who are considered behavior problems because they hit, they strike out, to kids especially or teachers when they're approached from behind and touched. There's a lot of people out there who have over-responsive senses of touch, and they look like prickly, grouchy people because they don't want anybody getting close to them, because if you stimulate their sense of touch, it hurts. It's a hurtful thing. I knew a girl that before I had my training, I met a girl who used to shave her arms every day, her arms and legs every day. She ate five foods and was a very prickly personality. She was a professor. So, she was in a position where nobody would ever have to touch her because she was up here and her students were out there, and she was a geology professor. So it was rocks, and rocks will never touch you.
I'm seeing severe coping mechanisms.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Well. And, here she was, 20, she was, I think, like probably about 28 when I met her, and she'd gone her whole life, and she was just like, oh, I'm just weird in that way. And I just wish, and I have no way of contacting her now, but I would just love to tell, you know, say, look, you've got touch defensiveness. You can do something about this. And so I actually get a lot of kids who come to me who've been kicked out of daycare, who have moved schools a few times because the parents think it's the teacher or the situation that makes their kids react like that. But it's, you know, it's as basic as their sense of touch. And not to say that it's just the sense of touch. There's usually underlying vestibular and proprioceptive issues. Like I said, touch is the third layer that I look at. I deal with everything else first. And actually, some of the things that really help with the touch defensiveness is lots of touch stimulation. And I recommend skin brushing to all my tactily defensive kids. And
can you say what that is?
Skin brush. You just, we give out these soft surgical brushes that they give you before you go to surgery to clean a site before you get it operated on. But I'm a big fan of Kiwi shoe brushes that you get at Fred Meyer's because they're easier to replace. And you actually, I like natural fibers. I think there's something to that. And you just brush the skin. You brush the arms. You brush the back. You brush the legs. Now, there's a whole protocol that you do where you use skin brushing with proprioceptive input, like joint compressions. But that's something you need to go through an OT to learn. I can't talk about that on air. But skin brushing in of itself will do wonders for your touch defensive child or your touch defensive adult self. There's thousands of people out there who have adults who haven't figured this out yet.
I think that's really interesting because it ties in with Chinese medicine a little bit, where skin brushing is oftentimes used to stimulate the immune system. And the immune system is this metaphor for a interface between our internal and external world. Hmm.
Well, I actually, some of our younger patients, I actually recommend they use something. It's called a derma roller.
Uh-huh.
And it's a little metal instrument. It's got a little barrel on the end of it, and it's got little metal points on it, but they're not sharp. It's just like different shapes. And
yeah.
So it sort of rolls a lot, and I have parents roll it on their back, and kids just love it.
It's very soothing,
it's
right?
Very
it's just
soothing.
Really, really soothing.
Yeah, very soothing.
We have them roll it along what's called the bladder channel, which parallels the nervous system on the back, and just make these long strokes down the back, and sometimes all the way down to the bottom of the feet.
Yes.
And the kid, and it just really
that's
calms
what I
them
do.
Down. It totally calms them down. They love it, and it stimulates their immune system. And it's, you know, I've seen all sorts of things clear up just with using the derma roller every day. It's
well,
amazing.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah,
that is so cool.
Yeah, and as it ties to allergies, which we're seeing so much of these days, and one perspective, a holistic perspective in Chinese medicine about that is overreactivity. It's a hypersensitized nervous system that's reacting to things that actually aren't harmful in and of themselves.
Yeah, yeah. But there's a perception that it's harmful, and it's genuine.
Yeah.
You know, it's genuine.
Well, they're feeling what they're feeling. You can't really
argue with the kid and tell them not to experience
what they're experiencing.
No, don't hit somebody when they touch you unexpectedly. Well, if somebody's hurting you,
right,
you're going to react, you know, and so, yeah.
So let's maybe just broadly talk about some case studies. You know, obviously, you know, we know there's a confidentiality issue, so we're not going to get into specific kids, but just kind of a broad sense of, you know, what this would look like. You know, a kid who's been kicked out of various daycares or, you know, schools.
Yeah, so that's I've had a few of those kids come to me who have a really hard time with peer relationships because the kids around them. Kids are unpredictable. They get along great with adults. They tend to be pretty smart kids that just are very reactive to their peers. And it's frequently kids that get in their space or teachers that get in their space or control issues. Kids with sensory integration challenges tend to be very controlling because they need to make sure that whatever comes out at them is predictable. And if it starts to get more and more unpredictable, then the more reactive they get. And so, you know, so a lot of these kids are in busy daycares, lots of stimulation, and they actually do better in the baby room because there's not nobody's in their face, and they get better, you know, get along better with kids that aren't going to be unpredictable.
Yeah, and it makes sense if they're dealing with, again, that underlying anxiety and insecurity, yeah, that they would want to have more of a controlled environment.
Yes.
Because if you're already on edge and you're just waiting for the next thing to happen versus, like, if you've got some environment where even if you just have a sense that you have control of it, that's going to give them a little bit of ease.
Yeah, yeah, and the sense is pretty huge. That's, you know, typically what I, you know, that's just kind of one of the types of kids I see. And what I'll do is I'll talk to parents about, one, preparing your child for everything that you're anticipating in the next hour or two, depending on how far ahead your child can think or perceive. And, you know, two, there's all sorts of sensory strategies you can do. A lot of kids I see have trouble with grocery stores, and there's things like wearing like a baseball hat to sort of block out the visual stimulation. There's something I call a hug vest that's a neoprene vest that has Velcro sides, so you can make it really tight, and so it hugs their body together.
Ooh, that's sounding like Temple Grandin.
It's like this totally kid.
A sense of containment.
And you should probably just say more about Temple Grandin, want to see that movie.
Temple Grandin. I can't remember the name of the movie right now, but you could Google Temple Grandin. I'm totally blanking on it, but she has autism, and she's actually an expert in working with cattle, and she designed all sorts of different ways to calm cattle as they're going through the slaughter. House actually,
but she's autistic and she actually
got down on all fours and just looked at what life was like from the perspective of a cow and what their life was like, and she came up with all these different ways to sort of calm animals and give them a better life, you know, considering what these animals give to us. She was able to help them out. So she actually, when she was a younger kid, she decided that because she was so because she had a lot of anxiety and she had a lot of discomfort in her own body, she saw a cow being squeezed in a squeeze cage before the vets were going to do some kind of procedure on it, and she saw how that squeeze relaxed the cow, and she thought, I'm going to invent something like that for myself, and she did as a college student, and it worked. And so she had a little squeeze cage in her dorm room, and that when she felt anxiety, she would just get in it, and she would pull this thing tight on herself, and it felt like she was being given a hug.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. I don't have a TV, so I don't know these things, but there's a infomercial out for a vest that you put on dogs that does the same thing.
Interesting.
Which I thought, wow, you can get a hug vest for your dog much more easily than you can get a hug vest for your kid.
And actually, I see adults who have issues in grocery stores, too, not just kids. So maybe
that's
good advice for anybody who goes into a grocery store.
Yeah.
Because it is really, it's designed to be overstimulating. It's designed to throw you off balance. So then you go for the comfort food.
Yeah. Oh, it's so true.
Wow.
It is so true. So what I try to do is give parents practical strategies, like on the spot. And then I also try to, you know, I do my best to try to teach them how to incorporate activities that stimulate their vestibular sense, their proprioceptive sense, their tactile sense, as much as possible in the child's day. And depending on what their life looks like, I'll try to design a home program that matches their lifestyle and their needs. And that's probably the hardest part of my job is, you know, trying to find that balance for parents in a way that works. Because I do believe the ones that are able to incorporate home programs to help their kid, you know, to help their kids during those situations are going to have the most success with helping their kids feel comfortable.
How about kids that you mentioned that are maybe more of in a shell? They're not hyperactive. They're actually just withdrawn. What kind of case studies or just experiences have you seen with that, and how would you approach it?
Well, you know, I see those much, much less because these aren't problem children. And I see it more with kids that have more diagnoses, low muscle tone, more, you know, just kind of shy and withdrawn. And like I said, they're not kids that scream problem kids. They're actually really easy. But honestly, you know, when I stop to think about it, it's most of those kids I see have diagnoses, you know, have some pretty, you know, bigger underlying neurological condition. But and so they don't move a lot. They don't do a lot. But one particular child that I might see is a child with really kind of just who is very, very laid back and doesn't like to move a lot. But you get them on a swing, and immediately their eyes sparkle. They're alert. They're looking around. Whereas before, they just kind of sit there with mouth agape, not really responding so much to adults in a way that adults can see.
And I would think that sometimes those kids probably get missed because they are sort of easier to deal with than the loud screaming kid who's getting in your face. So those kids are kind of there. It's like there's a whole level of connection that's being missed between the kids and the parents and the kids in the outside world.
Yeah.
Because the parents go, oh, well, oh no, he's so easy. I don't really have to do anything.
Yeah.
I
wish I could say, but that's the sort of thing that I guess I see more on a kind of a casual basis. I might see a child that's under responsive and like, you might want to try some more exciting activities. Mm-hmm. Their posture is slumped. They don't close their mouth. There's kind of this whole image, mm-hmm. kind of a lazy looking child.
Yeah. It's not engaged.
Engaged. Mm-hmm. Doesn't really have a good ability to reach out to other friends. I'm thinking about one kid in particular who was like that, but also had dyslexia. And so there's, there was definitely a pattern, something had happened that started affecting his visual processing later in life. So there's kind of a, like I said, I tend to see the kids that are more problem mm-hmm. kids.
Sure.
And then I'll get parents who come to, and the kids that are underreactive, I actually tend to see when they're older for that reason. Mm-hmm. It's like they're just not doing well in school.
Yeah, like the issues they're going to show up later.
Actually
from the parents' perspective, they show up later.
It's usually academic or social reasons, or, sometimes it's, a family that's really involved in sports and their kid just isn't that kid, isn't mm-hmm. like them. And mm-hmm. so then they'll come to me. But it's definitely much later in life than my reactive kids.
What I like about all of it is that everything is like a fun answer. Like all the things that you do are all joyful and fun and engage the family.
It is. It's really, and that's the beauty of it. It's a really, if you really work on providing this solution for your child or yourself, if you're listening to this and like, wow, that was me as a kid. You can do this now. Adults, there's plenty of sensory, adult activities that engage the senses as well. So it's pretty cool in that way.
So there's a couple more directions I want to go in. I know we're kind of running out of time.
Yeah.
One was I wanted to just get a little bit of a sense of, of working with the autistic kid
yes.
or the Asperger's kid, something on that spectrum.
Yeah.
And then I definitely want to talk a little bit about how you go about evaluating the home situation and how that plays into the relationship with the parent and the family with the kid and how to not – and we were talking during the break how – It can feel for the parent when they've got a kid who's quote a problem child that somehow they've done something wrong, and there can be a lot of guilt from the parent side.
Yeah.
But there may be things that the parents don't know that they could be doing and they're not aware of. So riding that line to try to help coach the family to make the situation better for the kid, but not have them necessarily blame themselves because part of it's our culture. We don't really know that.
Yeah.
Know any better.
Well, and I try to put when I see parents kind of go into this self-blaming pattern, I really try to point out the fact that, this is our culture. This is not something that, you should feel responsible for, because all the things that you did to raise your babies are totally culturally acceptable to keep your kid in a car seat. It's acceptable to use baby positioners at home instead of wearing your child. And
we talked about that's because we're just expected in our culture now to have a baby and go on.
Everything in life should be the same, and you have
a
kid.
Yeah. So I don't ever perceive a parent with a blaming at. I think when I first started out, I might have blamed the parents a little more, but now I just don't, and it's not part of my makeup anymore because I've seen what I consider really good parents who still do those things, and it's Yeah, it is what it is.
Most
you know?
People are doing the best they can based on what they know.
Everybody's doing the best that they can. Like everybody is.
So then in the intake process, it's really just getting a sense of where there might be opportunities in the household.
Yeah, yeah, and that's what I look for. That's what I look for. And a lot of times I actually see, you know, even parents who intuitively give their kids exactly what they need, but they don't necessarily know that until they come to me, they don't, you know, nobody's ever put it into words for them. You know, they just know that if they let their kid play outside 24/7, that, boy, he or she is much happier playing in the dirt and swinging and climbing and doing all that. And they just know it. I see that a lot with parents who have kids on the spectrum, the autism spectrum, who have figured that out. Their life is just much easier if they have active outdoor time. And I try to just give them ideas to how to, to add some variability to it, because there's, you know, still a piece missing.
I saw it was a map that showed, I think it went back to the 1920s or maybe 1940s, that showed what the range of a average, I think it was like 9 or 10-year-old, in relation to their house, like how far it would be normal for, it was like a couple of miles away from their house.
Yeah.
Right.
Versus like kids now where it's like this tight little radius around their house where they're allowed to go. So if you think about like how much we're like how we're limiting our kids because of fear, you know, like we don't want to let them out of our sight because something could happen.
Yes.
Versus, you know, 50 years ago, it was just kick them out of the house and hopefully they'll be back for dinner.
We a lot of that, I mean, we've cut our kids off from experiencing nature. You know, even just, you know, going for a walk. I spent much of my childhood in the woods, and that's just not acceptable nowadays.
Yeah.
And I think that's a shame. Like, I think that, you know, you get your senses stimulated in so many different ways when you have a relationship with the outdoor world. And not just parks. You know, I'm talking, like, looking at trees, you know, just climbing hills, playing in leaves. You know, it's not...
Like, uneven ground, not something
uneven
like
ground,
here,
Get off the cement already, like that.
And there's something else. Yeah, there's that, but there's also getting out of abstraction. So if you're looking at a computer screen or monitor, you're watching a show, there's like an abstract process in the nervous system that's continually happening. But when you go out into nature, you're alive with presence.
Yes.
You know, you're just really alive with your senses.
Yep, exactly. And you're in your body. And everything goes much easier in life when you're in your body. I mean, that's like I said, that's one of my goals with treatment is to do that, to help kids, you know, really get there.
Is yoga something that would be beneficial to
Absolutely.
These kids?
Absolutely.
You know, maybe meditation?
Martial arts, yoga, swimming is fabulous if your kid doesn't get too stimulated. You know, all the gymnastics,
I wonder about kids when they're that young if they really overdo it. I mean, I think tumbling is probably fine, but there's a certain level where it gets to where they're doing hours, you know, of gymnastics in their joints.
I'm a little less likely to recommend that one depending on the kid.
But I do think it can be fantastic. I just think there's a certain amount of, like, how much can we push a growing body to do those kinds of activities.
About diet, I mean, just curious if there's any things, you know, red flags right off the bat that are a factor that you make any recommendations.
So right off the bat, infants, if you have an infant that is withdrawn, that doesn't like to be held, huge red flag. A baby that doesn't appear to be making eye contact early on is another sign of withdrawal. And I've heard a few, you know, I've seen a few circumstances where that later turned into autism. So if your child isn't making eye contact when they're supposed to, I'd highly recommend getting checked out by either a vision specialist or an occupational therapist. Chronic irritability, some of the physiological things like chronic diaper rash. There's certain, you know, because when there's anxiety, your digestion gets disrupted. And so you'll see something like that. And so, you know, there's that to look at. It doesn't like to be held. Those are the babies I get really concerned about.
Are there a range of diagnoses that you can share with listeners that, you know, are common conditions that you see or come into your office?
Sure. I see, like, kids with, you know, syndromes like Down syndrome, Williams syndrome, autism, ADHD, ADD, so attention deficit without the hyperactive component. I see kids with who've kind of been through the foster system that get a diagnosis of reactive attachment disorder.
What's that?
an inability, like disrupted relationships. Like, so that's essentially like they never got attached to a primary caregiver. And so they actually perceive emotional closeness as threatening. And so these kids are, they can be really wild, like just very, very reactive. And in a scary way. And so I have, there's a few kids we see with that. And sensory integration and actually craniosacral therapy really work well with that. I see kids with Asperger's syndrome, dyslexia. What else? Sometimes I have to scramble for a diagnosis. They're just having a hard time, but there's nobody ever labeled them, and I don't like labeling. But, you know, they're uncoordinated. The developmental coordination disorders is something I often, you know, a code that I often use. You know, and these kids just bump into things. they don't have a good sense of personal space, and they often get up in people's faces. Because they need that closeness to feel. That tends to be a more of an underreactive response, actually. Kids that are fine with going into other people's personal space. So,
and so the difference between somebody who would get diagnosed as autistic or Asperger's. What can you say a little bit of the difference between those two?
Between autism and Asperger's.
I kind of think of them as sort of on a spectrum. But is there an actual way you differentiate between those two, or is it how withdrawn they
are? I'm not the one to make that call. Yeah. That's definitely a neuropsychologist arena for diagnosing that. The kids I see with the sensory integration problems are a component of any kid that gets on the spectrum. I mean, that's part of sort of what they look at. Kids with Asperger's tend to have disrupted peer relations, you know, just a hard time with making friends. And are kind of socially awkward. They tend to have a very focused, very, very, very focused interests. And, you know, but they're able to articulate them. Whereas someone who's more just on the autistic spectrum tends to, like an Asperger kid can probably get by, you know, you might have to be told that they've had that diagnosis. And whereas kids who get the autism diagnosis, they run a lot. They don't listen, you know, there's definitely like, a whole series of things. You know, they have repetitive physical behaviors, you know, whether it's pressing into things, shaking their hands, banging their heads. There's a whole, you know, you don't often see them out in public because their parents don't want to bring them out in public. It's hard.
The kids with the Asperger's diagnosis that I've met they seem to be actually rather smart, and they do. They can be a little quirky. So
yeah, no.
They don't relate to their peers necessarily, but they're really fun and interesting and intelligent.
Oh, they're fabulous.
Kids.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a way in which it's like they almost have to learn social behaviors. So I guess that's my experience.
And how to read social cues.
Yeah, that they don't have that sort of innate. They didn't pick it up. But if you give them a book to read and say that explains social cues, then they understand it. It's like they sort of learn it in a mathematical way as opposed to just picking it up just by osmosis.
But the
autistic kid won't do that. Or not necessarily won't, but I mean may not be able to versus the Asperger's kids I've seen.
They're definitely more teachable from a cognitive level.
And they seem like more aware that they don't have that ability and they're looking to try to develop it.
Yeah, so, you definitely can see that. Mm-hmm. There's definitely some awareness that they can have and I've seen kids that are, you know, autistic, and I say it with quotes, who can start looking more like they have Asperger's as they get older, if the underlying conditions are
addressed.
It gets dealt with effectively, and it's going to happen for some and not for others.
I really like what you said earlier about labeling, and that's such an important part of this too, because actually someone who's been diagnosed with Asperger's or is autistic, they are extraordinary people. And so, you know, and so gifts and capacities there that really need to be cultivated.
Mm-hmm.
And the tendency for us, you know, speaking broadly as culture or society, to try to make conformity so that we're all more comfortable, everything fits into this, you know, nice little piece of how everything should look and be, is really, you know, can work against people really developing mm-hmm. their great potential and capacities, as quirky as they might be.
Quirks are great.
I know.
They really are. They add, I mean, it just, and we need their skill set. We need,
And school doesn't necessarily make room for it. So sometimes I wonder, you know, like asking kids to sit in a classroom for hours upon hours and sort of forcing them to focus on two or three particular skills, we're not necessarily doing them a service. So, so we have like about, you know, 40 seconds left. We'd just like to have you say, where is your business? How would someone contact you if they're interested in learning more?
Okay.
And then if there's any web resources or books that you like parents to read.
You know, Google sensory integration. Like, that's, there's plenty of helpful sites out there. The SI Network is probably a more popular search result. Our clinic is Mountain Magic Therapy for Kids. It's on the Palmer-Wasilla Highway. And we've got several occupational therapists who work out of there who focus on these things. And my phone number is 746-7300. And we love to, even if you're not sure, there's things I can send you to sort of assess whether your child indeed has something that can be worked with. And,
Great.
So
Lisa Elliott Rector, occupational therapist specializing in pediatric care at Magic Mountain, Mountain Magic Therapy here in Palmer. Thanks for joining
us. Thanks for joining us in Bridge to Everywhere. Have a great night. Merry Christmas.
Yeah, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Thank you for joining us on the Bridge to Everywhere, broadcasting on KVRF 89.5 Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska. Like us on Facebook at Bridge to Everywhere to access more information, links and resources from our guests and show topics.